Hi everyone and welcome to this Media Box. Today we will talk about learning and we will talk about co-production and we will also talk about puzzles. My name is Magnus Johansson. I work here at Malmö University at the Department of Urban Study. I also work as a director for a local interaction platform related to Mistra Urban Future. I would also like to say welcome to my guest.
Hi, I'm Tim May.
Welcome, Tim May. And who are you?
Okay, well, I'm a professor in the Sheffield Methods Institute at the University of Sheffield in the UK. And I've spent quite some time looking at issues to do with co-production. I've written about these issues, and I have also been involved in Mr. Urban Futures for 8-9 years now.
Great. I would like to start this conversation with a metaphor of problem solving, and it's a very simple metaphor. It's about solving puzzles. When I ask people to, how do you start when you're solving puzzles? I think everyone says, I start with the corners. Or start with the frames. You start to finding specific pieces and then you started to putting pieces together so they make sense. But what is interesting with puzzles is when you're solving a puzzle, you always started with the pictures on the box. But what happens if it be a problem in the puzzle factory? And you're buying a puzzle with a beautiful ship on and instead there's another puzzle. Maybe it's a puzzle without corners. It's just a circular puzzle. It's a very specific puzzle. So you started to solve the puzzle and you have an idea about the solution. Because as soon as you name and frame a problem, you also name and frame the solutions. But then suddenly you get frustrated because the pieces you find in your puzzle doesn't fit into the frame, to the picture. Something is wrong. And I think one starting point for learning is when you become frustrated. When you think you have a solution, when you think you have a problem, but it doesn't work. When you are in that situation, when you started to laying puzzles and then you suddenly discover it doesn't work, how should you handle this, Tim? What should you do?
There's a simple question to start with. How do you handle not being able to do a jigsaw puzzle? Maybe extending the metaphor.
Yeah,
let's extend the metaphor. And you've already said that there's an issue of framing. Mm. Somebody has already determined what the puzzle will look like. They've already demarcated it or split it from its surroundings, perhaps through a photograph or something like this. And you're putting those pieces together. And in order to solve it, you start with the corners. But we could suggest that actually learning, and you already mentioned this, that learning is about coming across things that don't make sense to us. The question for us then, I guess, is learning confirmation of what you already know? Or is learning to be challenged in relation to the ways that you see the world? And we've got a difference here, I think, between reflection, that is the ability to think about what one does, and reflexivity, which is about trying to understand the knowledge we use to make sense of things and ask ourselves about the limits to our knowledge and what that says about not just what we know, but what we don't know. So it is not just a celebration of our technical skills to do something. It's also a recognition of our ignorance, of not knowing. And I think that when it comes to issues of learning and when it comes to matters of co-production, it's about a preparedness and a willingness to admit of your ignorance as much as it is a celebration of what it is that you know. And so the framing device that you describe, we have to ask who put the frames there in the first place? Who decides?
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question because you open two doors. One door is you step into discussion about knowledge and power and the power to decide what is normal, what is relevant. The other way to understand is to talk about practice and everyday practice that you could also frame through your everyday, through your routines. For example, if you work as a urban planners, you plan and you go to your office and you sit on your desk and you do your plans and you learn to put together a specific puzzle, a professional puzzle. And then again, if we go back to the question about power, there are also some solutions or some framing that are accepted as normal. When we talk about urban development, for example. Everyone talks about the creative city and the importance of the knowledge economy. And even sustainability has becoming some kind of normalized frames. No one disagrees about the importance of sustainability. But it's open up to another things that we have discussed and the relation between clarification and contextualization.
Well, I think the differences between clarification and contextualization are ones about space and knowledge. If we clarify something to ourselves, then to some extent it brings to awareness something we did not necessarily know about before. So clarification is also something about re-comprehending, re-understanding, or advancing understanding. Contextualization, I think, is a different matter. I think contextualization is about saying that you know something about the places that you work in, about the context that you navigate in, and about the things that you do within that. And if we start talking about learning here, we immediately start talking about some quite difficult issues about you might celebrate your practices. And let's be honest, people's everyday practices are wonderful sources of celebration. You know, the dexterity, the ability people have to do what seem to be mundane and routine things are beautifully personified by, for example, sports people who do things incredibly easily. And the more easily they do it, the more you know that they are amazingly skilled and put a lot of work into doing it. It's not just a natural process. It's something that derives from tens of thousands of hours of continuous repetition and practice and all these things. And so in those terms, we can celebrate that through what we might call an economy of effort. In other words, people appear to do things which are actually quite complicated and difficult very easily. Mm. And people talk about craft work in that kind of way, the craft of doing something, of making something. And there's a tangibility to the product, what is made. Mm. And we can celebrate that and we can see it. And there is a relationship then between people and what they've made. But we're also talking about something that's not so tangible. We're talking about a change, perhaps at an individual or group level, about how people re-perceive things, re-understand things, or change their forms of perception of things. And this is much more difficult. And it's difficult, I think, for several reasons. It's difficult, first of all, because it's challenging to the individual. We talk wonderfully about things about critique, and we talk about critical ideas and these sort of things. But actually, at the end of the day, how far do we really want to take critique? Do we want to take it so far that actually we are no longer able to act anymore because we're constantly thinking about our actions rather than acting? We might call that reflexivity, the ability to think back on our actions and think about the forms of thought that we use for those actions, but it can lead to paralysis and doubt and uncertainty. And that's a peculiar thing, because the only universal perhaps we have with knowledge is doubt, is to be skeptical. On the other hand, you're talking about people who have to do things on a daily basis within cities for sets of reasons whose performances are then judged according to the organizational context in which they find themselves. And if we're not sensitive to the context in which people work and understand those, and if we're not sensitive to the context that people navigate through in their everyday lives and their abilities to juggle all sorts of things, then we lose that contextualization and we lose the ability to be able to understand. But that's one component of learning, to understand. The other component might be to explain. In other words, the conditions and the relationship between the conditions and the characters and what people do. And when we enter into that terrain, we enter into a long established but nevertheless important debate about the relationship between understanding and explanation.
Yeah, and one thing that pops up is go back to our profession as university teachers. Both you and I work with sustainable urban development, and we are teaching about sustainable urban development, and we are teaching our students to be critical, because in sustainability, in the idea of sustainable urban development is a critique, because we agree upon that the development today are not sustainable. But in the same time, we also would like to teach or help our students to have the ability to act. So we actually create some kind of tensions within our students. If we think that working with sustainability is like to being an athlete or a football player, when do we know when we're making goals, and when do we know when we succeed? How could we concentrate the skills? And the students often ask for that. They're asking for tools, and they're asking for toolkits and methods so they can go out from university and save the world. And in the same time, both you and I know that this is no sense to give. Of course, we can give them tools and we can give them methods. There are tons and tons of books with tools and methods for sustainability. But in the same time, we also want them to become critical and becoming aware of the context. So it's a dilemma when we put our students into a dilemma.
I think that's true. Students may be placed in that situation if there's an expectation that they're both going to change something and to do good performances according to the rules of a game that other people have set. And ultimately, that's really what we're dealing with. Carrying on with that sporting metaphor, that, you know, who sets the rules of the games? Who's deciding this? Critical capacity is different from what we might call affirmative learning. Affirmative learning is essentially gaining more and more competences to do things more efficiently in terms of what is already done. The critical capacity is to ask about the rules of the game and to change those, to alter things. Once we start introducing sustainability into that equation, we have both something that we can ask how we might evaluate our actions by having more sustainable outcomes. But it's a wonderful and worrying word, sustainability, because it means everything to everybody,
yes,
and thus nothing to anybody. Mm. It's a way of organizing people around something that apparently disparate politically minded people can all agree upon. So in other words, the end is suspended. In other words, how would we know that things are more sustainable? Does it mean that we're acting in a way now whereby the resources that we consume will not compromise future generations? Classic definition. Are we acting in a way that sustainability is about justice? And if it's about justice, then it has a social dimension, because it's about bringing the social and the physical together, and about understanding that you can't ask people to care about the environment and assume they are simply separate from it if the environment doesn't care for them. So we're introducing now, in terms of learning and critique, a normative dimension. It's an ought question. How ought you to behave? And how do you know that you're having an effect or you're making a difference? Mm. And so the affirmative and the transformative are really important here. But in terms of pedagogy and of teaching, we have to be a bit careful, and I think this was what was implied in your questioning, that what we do is saying that unless somebody is sufficiently critical, unless somebody is constantly and continuously doing something that's different that will affect change, then they're failing in some kind of way. And the fact is that universities are caught in the same thing that we find in our everyday lives if we take these matters seriously, and I think everybody does at some point in their lives. And has to think about it on an everyday basis, or does. But I think we're caught in something that's a product of our times, where we ask ourselves, okay, we can increase our competences, and therefore knowledge is instrumental. It's about finding better means to the same ends. Whereas critique is about saying these ends aren't okay anymore. These ends need to be changed. It's about reorientation. It goes into the realm of politics. And at this point, people have some very funny ideas about knowledge and learning and politics and is and ought. In other words, that essentially what knowledge is to produce toolkits. And even the language of a toolkit.
Yeah.
In other words, there's something definable and tangible that you're then going to work on in a particular kind of way, and that you can find a certain spanner. And we know that if you give people a hammer, they're going to find a nail.
Of course.
Yeah. So the idea that we're simply unproblematically giving people a tool for a particular job is a bit of a deceit. But it is something that's constantly and continuously referred to demonstrate the relevance of what it is that we're doing. Because if we don't equip people with the tools to do things better, with the craft, if you like, then exactly what is our purpose? But if we take that a little bit further, we can say that maybe there's a difference between training and education. In other words, that you can train people to do a task more efficiently, but do you educate people for what? Do you educate them to be free? To think for themselves, to think differently? And I think these kind of questions of pedagogy are really important.
When I teach in the undergraduate program in environmental science, I very often get the questions from the students, what could I do how could I convince someone to employ me? I can understand there's a need for my knowledge, but how, who would hire me? I'm not a doctor, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have this label. Some of the students struggle to find a label, to find these toolkits, to find something they can write down in the CVs. And at the same time, we want to encourage them to have this self-esteem, to go out and to be so educated and be so strong in the idea that they could make a change. Maybe self-esteem is the core competence for people who want to work with sustainable urban development.
Well, self-esteem is an important thing, but we cannot separate the individual from the environment of which they're a part. And our self-esteem is gained through the different forms of kind of cultural settings in which we find ourselves, the norms, the competencies, how others evaluate ourselves. Us is how we are evaluated in terms of how we see ourselves. So they're not separate issues. But I think self-esteem is important. But I mean, taking the university and what you're describing straight away, this increasing instrumentality is not about the university. It's part of society as a whole. And this is an increasing element, without a doubt, in much the same way as that knowledge is increasingly instrumentalized as really as a more efficient means towards the same ends. So too, it is understandable that when people come to university, they want to acquire an educational capital to get jobs. That's a condition of survival and of necessity, and also, of course, perhaps to furnish debt. This is understandable, but it reminds me of a wonderful example in terms of the tensions between teaching somebody to be critical and having a critical capacity and what then eventually happens. And I was teaching a course when I worked at the University of Durham on management and organization. And the critical nature of this was important. How does management work? How does it function? What prerogatives does it have? How does command and control work within organizations, human resources, performance measures, and all these things? And I taught it from a very particular point of view. And at the end of this course, there was one student who'd done very well indeed. And he came to see me and he was very pleased that he got the grade he did. But he also, there was something about his demeanor that made me think, what's the matter? So I said to him, is there something else you want to tell me? He said, yes, I've got a job. And I said, oh, that's great. I'm glad you got a job. And his starting salary was very good indeed. And he told me he got a job working for a very large management consultancy. And he said, I know that's going to be difficult because really everything you've taught me about critical understandings of management and of organizations has been really useful. And it was fantastically useful in my interview. And they're going to give me a really good starting salary. And I know that this isn't really what I wanted. But he said, what I'm going to do, and he was about 23 or 24 at the time, he said, I'm going to work for this management consultancy till I'm 40. I'm going to make lots of money, and then I'm going to write a book about how it's all nonsense. And I thought, okay, so I have enabled you to get a job, which actually at the time was more money than I as a lecturer were on to do that. At that level, I'm very happy for you. At another level, you've just given me an explanation where you've wanted the job and you've got the job and you can see a lot of advantages in it. And now you've relieved yourself of any responsibility for that by saying that you're going to do it for 16, 17 years and then you're going to write a book telling everybody how nonsense it is. And I think this is a wonderful illustration of how critique can be absorbed and rationalized by individuals. We can tell ourselves all sorts of stories and we can narrate our lives in particular ways and we can justify ourselves. And these practices of justification, if we start to look at those as well as critique, can have self-fulfilling prophecies attached to them in the sense that we say to ourselves, we've done these things for very good reasons and there was a contextual factors that made us do them. The danger, of course, is that you come to a point in time where you say to yourself, okay, what have I done? What can I actually say to myself about what I've achieved? What are the things that I am most proud of? And how would I have known that I'd made any difference if I wanted to in the first place? And there will always be a point in time in which we all ask ourselves those kind of questions. And the little choices that we make over time maybe mean eventually that wisdom only comes in retrospect.
One thing that we should bring up in this conversation is about co-production. Could co-production be a way to challenge justification? Or
I think it depends on who's involved and what they're talking about, because it could be, of course, one could suggest that you could bring disparate people together for the purposes of co-producing knowledge to effect change, but they all agreed upon what they really want to do is produce another toolkit.
Yeah.
So you're back to where we started.
Yeah,
I think exactly. Co-production is intriguing because it's symptomatic in a sense, although it has a very long history, but it's symptomatic in a sense of wanting to find another way, another magic solution to the problems we find. And I think we have to be very careful in assuming that they're simple solutions. And they come in many guises. You know, you can see this in the studies of innovation. You can see it in universities when people say they're advancing knowledge all the time. I always wonder how much knowledge is being advanced. If we're all advancing all these sort of things, why have we still got so many problems? And I think there we run into a really interesting relationship between knowledge and action. And I think maybe that's another way of understanding what you were saying about students. In other words, that if I'm equipped with a certain knowledge, it means I will act in a certain way. But of course, our knowledge always relates to the context in which we find ourselves, and our dexterity and our ability to act in those contexts depends on other factors. Yeah. It depends on some senses of, as you say, self-evaluation, which isn't just knowledge-based. It's about how one is, how one feels. Mm-hmm. And the concept of feeling and emotion there become really important. Mm-hmm. And knowledge gets terribly ambivalent about emotion because, of course, we're talking about reason. And we're talking about particular ways of stripping out other elements of our identities and who we are by just focusing on facets of ourselves. And I think we often don't take those issues of value and effect seriously enough in these things. But it's, of course, about expectation. You know, knowledge is sold as a solution. And universities are in the business of equipping people with the educational capital to go out in the marketplace and advance themselves. And that's how they sell themselves, to do that. On the other hand, you know, do you judge your knowledge by your ability to earn more money? And everybody would claim, whoever they are in an organization, particularly at chief executive level, that they have the ability to be able to take a holistic overview of their organizations. No individual can possibly do that. But we pay people according to the idea we attribute that value to them to do it. So we're also talking about attributed value. What is more important? We're talking about, if you like, a culture of recognition. Why and reward? Why are some people rewarded more than others? Why are some people recognized more than others? And what are the assumptions about what it is that they're doing, which apparently allows that to happen? Now, when we get into that, we start to really take things apart.
Today, we could see that when we talk about sustainable urban development, we're laying similar puzzles, and we're laying similar puzzles on a global level. And we're talking about best practices and good examples. And it seems that we have a situation today that tend to neglect the local circumstances, that you can have the same sustainability, not depending on where you are in the world.
Yes, I mean, I think best practices, I think, a wonderful example of what I'm talking about, because, of course, people earn a great deal of money in these cultures of recognition, and there isn't any recognition without some redistribution attached to it and remuneration. But people earn a great deal of money by going around and providing very selective histories of best practice, because everybody's looking for something to emulate, something that they can aspire to, something they can use in their context. And it's only later on that you start to find out some of the realities about what was really behind the best practice. But these stories that are told, these things that are narrated, it's unfortunate that there isn't always a proper honesty about them. But of course, they wouldn't be best practice if there was the honesty, because they're supposed to also, like knowledge, be transferable across time and across place and across space. And therefore, they work as kind of models that attract people. There are solutions to problems not yet identified even. Or they may be even particular lenses to find problems that weren't necessarily there before. And if you look at the circulation of ideas in terms of knowledge and learning and forms of learning, all sorts of gurus have come up over time saying these are the models to learn. These are the ways that knowledge should be used. We have a knowledge economy. We have a knowledge society. These are the futures. We're in a stage of post-industrialization. And people start to perpetuate those models, and people get enormous kudos out of them. They make careers out of this.
Yes.
That happens in academia, and that happens in consultancies. But the learning through context, that sort of element of it, you have to wait later on for that. And sometimes these models are transferred from cities to cities in terms of sustainable development. And the practitioners in those cities are left bewildered about trying to make sense of them. And the sense-making in terms of learning in context. That importance of trying to make sense is regarded as secondary to the transfer of the model, yes, or the transferability of the model. Because if you start to listen to people in context, then you have to take context seriously. And interestingly, that means the people who have that kind of contextual knowledge are the ones who are the experts. And we start to challenge the whole politics of expertise.
But that also takes time to understand the context. A couple of weeks ago, I was have a very absurd experience, because I was a part in a workshop in Malmö. And there were people, there were experts from European Union who was there to tell us about local sustainable urban development. It was so absurd, because here you have this very well-paid expertise from London or from Brussels who come down and just tell us rubbish. They give us these clichés and they say, oh, we need to build community trust. Yes. We need to be very focused and have a very clear goal. Yes. So we spend a whole day just to listen to rubbish. And it was so frustrated, because here in the room was filled of people who know the area and have worked in the area. And I worked in the city for many, many years. But they was forced to get into these workshops because there was a condition for the funding, for the European Union funding. If you go back to the puzzle metaphor, they come with empty boxes and then they try to squeeze in the local puzzle into those empty boxes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that seminar that you describe is a nice example of what I'm talking about, because there, if we think of knowledge, let's think of knowledge in terms of character, content, context, and consequence. Let's put those four things together. At different points of time, character is severed from context, and it's linked straight to the content of knowledge. So that politics of expertise that you have just described is a good example of the relationship between character, the individual who is expert, with the content of their knowledge that other people have to listen to. If you ask them to listen to the context that was evident in the audience, the context starts speaking back to the content, and you undermine the prerogatives of what is going on there. You immediately start to, in other words, undermine the politics of knowledge that is going on in that room, because you speak back to that relationship and you say, you might be an expert on that content, but it is not meaningful to me here. Mm. It doesn't make sense. Mm. Now, they could say, but it was true for where we are. So meaning and validity start to bounce around in the room. In philosophy of science and social science, these are important debates, and everybody assumes that it's philosophical and therefore not relevant. Mm. It is relevant. It's happening all the time, these kind of things. So it's about the exceptionality of their character according to their expertise, given the content of the knowledge there in that room. And everybody has to sit and listen to it, because it's assumed they need to learn.
Exactly.
Because if you just take the context in which you work and you celebrate the context will always be the same. So back to your issue about critique. If we only stay within our context and keep reproducing that, can we say there is anything necessarily transformative that will change that? Is there something that revises the context, alters the context? Sometimes the content of knowledge will do that. It will come in and change things and get people to think about them in different ways. And that's the kind of point that people often make about knowledge being revelatory. In other words, it's, oh, I didn't realize that before. I have that moment where exactly. I suddenly of realization. But there are other times when equally practitioners within sustainable development will say, you don't understand my context. Now, that's important, because we're talking about a particular form of knowledge. If we start to become much more nuanced about knowledge here, and not forgetting our relationship between knowledge and learning, then we start to say that's contextual knowledge. You're dealing in that room with something different, which is propositional knowledge. Mm. This is the case, therefore. Mm. There's no what if in that. There's no what is the knowledge if. Mm. And there is also a severing of a relationship between knowing what about something and knowing how. So back to what you're saying about the technical competence and expertise to do something, we start talking about the intelligence, in other words, the ability and context to adapt knowledge to a context. And that's really kind of what intelligence is. It's the ability to make that happen. And instead, we've created this whole circuits of knowledge in which there are people who apparently will come and tell you what you didn't know before. And if you start to not accept that premise, if you start to say, hang on a minute, how have you walked into this room encased in privileges, knowing something I don't, and you're coming here to tell me, it moves away from learning to being didactic.
Yeah.
You are being told something. And people don't react very well to being told things. And so, you know, what you were saying earlier about teaching, it's interesting because sometimes there is an assumption, of course, that the dialogue in the teaching room isn't a dialogue. It's about casting pearls to those who are ignorant.
Yeah, exactly.
But everybody who comes into that room has that experience. But depending on the knowledge that is being circulated in the room at the time, you may want to deny the experience or you may want to admit of the experience. It depends what knowledge that we're talking about at that particular moment in time. And different disciplines, of course, have different views on that. Because you know, if it's the social sciences or it's the arts and humanities and those sort of things, it's about a more often seen as a more humanistic perspective. Mm. The person is centered in some senses or another. So the forms of knowledge and who is talking and what they are talking about. We always have to exercise a critical reflexive idea of that because we will be disappointed in knowledge if we're not.
It's one thing, one detail here which bothered me a bit that I hope you can help me to resolve.
I'll try.
Yeah, try. But if you go back to the practitioners who said, well, this is not relevant for my context and this knowledge is not relevant for my practice. And I cannot use this knowledge. It's too theoretical. The problem or the challenge is that the local context could also be very conservative because we are working... I think the core in sustainable urban development is transformation. And something that I think, and I struggle with, is how could I handle context? Did I not really respect? Or if I think there's a problem in the context, and if it's just about resistance, how much respect should I have for the context? and how it's also a moral and an ethical issue.
Yes. Yes, it is. And whereas before I was talking about the severing of that relationship between character and content and context and consequence, you're dealing with another element to that. The person who came from Brussels, I think you said, to do a best practice seminar to cast the pearls amongst those in Malmö, did something that related the character to the content because context wasn't so important. It had to be. You're talking about practitioners who take character and context and they relate those two things. And the context and the contextual knowledge there becomes absolutely important. But of course, we also know that there, within organizations, there is a kind of dynamic conservatism. In other words, that people appear to be busy. They appear to be slightly frenetic at times. They say they don't have time for anything. And what happens is the organization reproduces itself in particular ways. And despite the best abilities of people, it still remains that. And so there's a kind of dynamic standing still. Nothing changes. And a lot of organizations are like that. Now, there are good and bad things about that. When you said transformation earlier, I think we're back into this question of transformation for what? If I go up on the roof of this particular building and I look around at Malmö and I look at the changes, I see a lot of transformation.
Yes.
The question is, transformation for whom? Mm. Who benefits? Mm. And in what ways do they benefit? And who are the people who are going to get the best advantage out of these transformations? Mm. And what do they mean? And I think here we're dealing with how it is that physical change is sometimes much easier to deal with. New buildings, new office blocks, new places. And the issue then becomes, well, what about the social dimensions of this? That's much more difficult and intractable to encounter. And it's not to suggest that the social and physical do not relate to each other, but I think the wicked problems, those problems that would prefer to be brushed under the carpet, are often the ones that we need to take out from under the carpet. And that means that there must be a preparedness and a willingness to say, we don't know, but each of us has something to bring. And this is where you talked about practitioners and context. We have to understand our knowledge isn't just contextual. It is also relational. It is connected to others. Is it connected to other places? Mm. It's perhaps even connected to other times through memory, what we carry with us in terms of our biographies and those sort of things. And it's only by creating spaces where we come together to get a kind of relational knowledge and an understanding. That takes time. Mm. It does take trust. Mm. And it also takes a sensitivity, I think, to the different positions in which people find themselves. Because some people will be more confident and able to do that than others. And also, in some instances, it won't be acceptable to do that with people who feel they're exposed and they feel that their self-esteem,
yeah, exactly, and it's
would be upset by that. So I think we need to have a better set of expectations about knowledge. We have some really overbearing ideas about what knowledge will bring us. Somehow it will, despite all the critiques of the Enlightenment, despite all of the stuff about how knowledge will do this, we still labour under this idea that knowledge will necessarily lead us to something better. It requires more than just knowledge.
Yeah, and it's also interesting because you bring up it a couple of times during this conversation, the importance of feelings and how you feel about knowledge. What also comes up to my mind is the whole discussion about fake news and alternative facts. And we have growing global movements who say, no, we don't believe in the climate change, and we haven't seen the climate change, that it's just a conspiracy made by Chinese to attack the American oil industry. And people who are really critical about knowledge and really guided by feelings, we can see some trends when people using feelings in a very problematic way. The feeling for the nation and the feeling for what it's true and this. So we actually are back in some 18th century position when science started to slowly move forward.
Yes, I mean, I think you're right. It is about that. And of course, interestingly, it's back to expectations of knowledge as well, because in relation to climate change, what would ultimate proof look like? What would something that apparently in terms of knowledge is unassailable look like? It would be something which everybody in all times and all places would all agree upon as being the case and beyond dispute. When has knowledge ever lived up to that promise? When has knowledge ever provided anything quite like that when it comes to the relationship between the social and economic dimensions of life and the environment? And of course, this is what has happened. We have started to collapse all these particular spheres in certain ways, and they become more and more complex in terms of how they are intertwined. But the complexity doesn't relieve us of the responsibility to do something about it. Mm. But the more we suggest they're complex, then the more the element of doubt comes in. Mm. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is a very deliberate manufacture of doubt.
Mm. Yeah.
And to produce a skepticism amongst the population in terms of the idea, for example, of evidence. And we hear a lot about evidence-based policy, or we put it the other way, policy-based evidence.
Yeah.
And as if it was about evidence. And here what we've done is we've turned towards science, broadly defined, and I include the social sciences in that as well. And we've turned towards them from a political point of view to say that political knowledge, which is partly fact-based but normative in orientation as well, why would we elect for politicians if we didn't do that? And they say, well, science has told us. So the demarcation between political knowledge and scientific knowledge starts to collapse, and the boundaries between those start to collapse, which means those persons who want to engineer a particular kind of world for themselves are able to play on the collapse of those boundaries and able to mobilize all sorts of forms of evidence to support what are ultimately biases. And we're dealing, I think, with, and it's like a practitioner and contextualization, we're dealing with situatedness disguised as something else. We're dealing with the particularity of certain kind of views disguised as being in a popular vein. Yeah. And when that starts to happen, then something peculiar happens in terms of knowledge. The analysis and the deliberation, one in a democratic sphere of deliberation, and the analysis that takes place within a, say, epistemic community of scientists or others who agree upon something collapse. And analysis and deliberation disappear, and democracy is used for other means. And when that happens, we can be fairly guaranteed it's not good. Because these different spheres have then collapsed, they're being deliberately deliberately obscured in terms of their differences. And science is used for all sorts of purposes. And it's deliberately contested. People say, well, it's contested, so they can't tell us anything. At what point does science ever say that the content of the knowledge would automatically lead to certain consequences? You know, that's for deliberation. That's what politics should be about.
Yeah.
And not collapsing them.
Yeah, and the paradox, because if the worst scenarios will happen, if the climate change will be so catastrophical, that then everyone will feel climate change, but then it will be too late.
Yes.
So when we agree about climate change, and when we agree upon, then we can't do anything. As long as we could disagree, there's still opening for changes or for alternative directions.
Yes, so. I think that disagreement's really important. But of course, we're talking about a time duration here as well. You know, the immediacy of consequence, back to those connections. The best way that in terms of, you know, doing future forecasting, which we've done in the past, say, looking towards 2050, the best way that people are able to comprehend these changes is talk about their grandchildren and their lives. So it goes down to maybe two generations down and say, what sort of world are we making for them? Because interestingly, when it comes to knowledge, you have to situate it in terms of the particular spheres of your own understanding. So what is described to us as knowledge by description in terms of consequence, has to be brought down to knowledge by acquaintance. In other words, those connected with us, those for whom we have affinity and feeling. And you see that, you can see that, of course, in ministerial briefings that happen in terms of policy. You know, the minister goes, well, what does this work? Well, minister, when it comes to your particular constituency or locality or the area you represent, this is what would happen. Oh, that would be terrible. So it has to be, or, oh, great. It has to be brought down to that level of familiarity. And so when that happens, there's a translation of knowledge that's going on from a described consequential kind of knowledge to a contextual kind of consequential knowledge, because that's the way that it works. So we move from the abstract down to the particular, or the general to the particular, and these things bounce around all the time. And sometimes I don't think we always discriminate well enough between them, and we expect things of knowledge that actually it could probably never fulfill.
Yeah, which puts a lot of hope in knowledge.
A lot of hope in knowledge. And what is scientific knowledge, except the most extraordinary thing? It's something that apparently could solve all our problems without ever raising any.
Yeah, and then also, if you go back to where we start this conversation about the puzzle, maybe we should have a picture of knowledge like a puzzle that every piece is alive.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, whilst we sit here and we say that there are these particular issues, we have to remember that a lot of people out there who don't have any of these qualms about knowledge at all. They are constructing vast forms of data about people's habits and about what they are doing, and they are going to sell those, and that knowledge is being commodified. So if we're going to talk about the real and the ideal, in other words, what could be and what is, that is happening now. The storage of massive amounts of data, which themselves, knowledge is power. Yeah. And it's being sold, and it's being sold more and more. And on that basis, I think we also have to have a kind of realpolitik of this. In other words, we have to understand that's the reality, and we have to grasp that reality and have to grasp how it actually works before we can come up with sensible solutions for the possibility of it being otherwise.
Yeah, and we are in a situation when algorithms and programs created knowledge. It's beyond our control in somewhere.
Yeah, it's creating views of whole groups of people.
Yeah.
It's not about the individual as such, although it might be about their particular patterns and behaviors on the internet, but it's also aggregated into all types of data that then can be sold and moved on and people targeted. And of course, what's happening there, and this is where I think knowledge and being are really important to our discussions, is because that's constructing a view of people as consumers who are based in the exchange of goods and services on the marketplace. And if we see a situation, and we've seen this with the use of Twitter, with the use of internet, and the suggestions and allegations regarding recent elections in the States and potentially also in England in the future, and interfering with those, then what we are seeing is whole ways of trying to distort people's perceptions by bombarding them with information and descriptions of what is. And so there is almost a war going on there out there about knowledge and using knowledge for particular purposes and particular ends. And this knowledge politics is intensifying. And the more data we have, the more it will intensify, but also the more important it is.
I would like to end up with two things. The first thing I would like to bring up is go back to the university and go back to our roles as teachers and knowledge producers, and something that it's really important that we have discussed before. But what kind of knowledge is produced in the university? They are not produced anywhere else. Why should we keep the university? This is a really provoking question, because when we have all this knowledge production going on, and we have the consultant companies, and we have these algorithms, but has the university lost its role?
Well, of course, for some people it hasn't. I mean, you know, in terms of what I've written about universities and indeed work for universities, it's always that central question. What is distinctive about the knowledge you produce that could not be produced elsewhere? It's a hard question to answer. And for many people, it comes down to a number of things. It comes down to the rigor with which the knowledge itself is exposed to. It's exposed to peer review. It's exposed to particular judgments of one's peers who are working on similar things and therefore have a profound and intimate understanding of the particulars of what you're doing and will look at it from the point of view of past research and from the point of view of your method. That's a very particular construction of knowledge that's going on there that wouldn't necessarily be applicable to the humanities, for example. But there is that of one thing. The other thing is time. If there is the frenetic pace of change that we see outside and people are always wanting to innovate, and if they're not innovating, they assume they're being complacent. And if everybody out there is an entrepreneur, then it seems that we're living in a world so fast change and so quick, we can't keep up with it. It's not possible. But that isn't really the case. These are devices to try and get people to do things or think about themselves in different ways. And there's a frenetic kind of activity that goes on there, which is beneficial. Because when people are moving that fast and not really feeling they've got time, then they're not thinking necessarily about what they're doing. They're just doing. So this relationship between thinking and doing is a kind of interesting one from a reflexive point of view. And you might argue that that's the thing that's not with us so much anymore. And we need to create this reflexive spaces. If the university is anything, it is that third space for that kind of reflexivity. Not only the ability to do that and bring disparate knowledges together, not just the knowledge that is within the university. And let's be honest, there are many different knowledges in universities. They're not homogeneous organizations. But if we were to do that, then it's a third space of possibility, a space of deliberation and a space of examination that isn't possible anywhere else, not in the municipalities, not in the business organizations. And the university needs to do that. And instead of trying to replicate what is happening within business, it needs to say to itself, if I do that, business will do it better. And there are many consultancies that would claim they do things with methodological rigor, but they do so in quicker timeframes, and they do so according to needs of business. And this is where I think we deceive ourselves if we genuinely believe that knowledge can be submitted to supply and demand in the university. It is submitted to supply and demand because that's how large corporations and smaller consultancies reproduce themselves. If we do that within the university, we will undermine our distinctiveness. That isn't to say that the university mustn't be part of this, because if it's too distant from it, it won't understand it. But if it's too close to it, it'll just replicate it. And somewhere between those two things lies the distinctiveness of what the university is.
I will finish with try a thought on you. Could we say that it's also characterized by modesty? By radical modesty, that when we produce knowledge within the university, we also do that with a modest approach and say we may be wrong.
You could imagine vice chancellors everywhere thinking a mission statement of producing, teaching and research for radical modesty wouldn't really attract very many students. But I think we are surrounded by so much hyperbole So much innovation, so much change, and so many things. Perhaps the university is a site for people to become a little bit more modest about their aspirations when it comes to knowledge. And of course, if you do that and you ask what you can and cannot expect of knowledge, of those factors that essentially encourage students to come to university, they want to acquire something. But it's also about understanding limits. It's about not knowing things, and it's about the admission of not knowing things. And knowledge and ignorance are not very cozy together. But it was beautifully personified, of course, by people like Bertrand Russell. The more I know, the more I realize, the less I know. Whether that's a very good strapline for a university to sell itself to people, I'm not sure. And Bertrand Russell also wrote a book called In Praise of Useless Knowledge. And for many people, it should be, the university should be for the purposes of the cultivation of the mind. But this becomes quite a kind of Socratic idea of only for elites. And universities do need to be more than that. They can reach out. They can reach out to different communities, and they can offer a space, a third space, outside of, for example, the municipality, the business organization. And they can offer that space to bring people together to learn. And I don't think universities are particularly effective learning organizations. But I think their distinctiveness can come by bringing people together. And all those different points of view will come together in that kind of dialogue. And the university can be a place and an institution where it has a point of view on those different points of view. And that's where its distinctiveness lies. And to do that, it needs to teach people, and it needs to conduct research in a way that is far more co-producing than is currently the case.
I think that's an excellent way to end this conversation. And also, I hope that gives some thoughts to our listeners to think further. And I think we stopped there, and then I hope we could continue this discussion in some other place, in some other circumstances. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.